You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Today's show is the second episode of a two-part case. We recommend you listen to our episode, The Rillington Place Strangler, Part 1, before listening to Part 2. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. In 1950, 25-year-old Timothy Evans was convicted of murdering his wife, Beryl, and their one-year-old daughter, Geraldine. Tim said that his neighbor, John Reginald Christie, was responsible for the murders, but nobody believed him. He was not granted a retrial, and despite professing his innocence to the end, he was hanged later the same year. Christie had served in World War I, but after a mustard gas attack, he returned home, scarred physically and emotionally. After a couple of prison stints and nearly a decade of separation from his wife, he seemed to have pulled himself back together. He even worked as a special constable, patrolling the streets of Notting Hill, but he abused his position of power. He was known to turn a blind eye to women who worked in the sex trade, providing that they slept with him. Christie had murdered two women in the early 1940s, but their bodies had not been discovered at the time of Tim's trial. Christie could very well have gotten away with murder if the urge to kill again did not get the better of him. At the trial of Tim Evans in 1950, Christie's previous criminal offenses were made public, and as a consequence, he lost his job at the Post Office Savings Bank. He fell into depression and lost 28 pounds. It's more than 10 kilograms. He had been unemployed for 8 months when he found a clerical position with British Road Transport Services. He managed to hang on to this job for 2 years. He could keep up appearances once again. He seemed like any other unremarkable man trying to make a living in post-war London. It is said that he was fastidious about keeping the house in order and would make a point of having dinner ready when Ethel came home from work. That was rather unusual at the time for a 1950s husband to take the chores of cooking and cleaning upon himself. Perhaps it was his guilty conscience about everything he did behind Ethel's back that made him want to deceive her by playing the part of a good husband. Or perhaps it was his desire to be in control that made him take charge of the household. Neighbors would say that he was courteous, always tipping his hat as he walked past, greeting them. He was not known to be very sociable and simply seemed like the introverted type. If neighborhood kids played in the street outside of 10 Rillington Place, he was quick to tell them to keep the noise down. Nobody would have ever suspected that this keen gardener was in fact tending to the graves of two murder victims in his backyard, Ruth First and Muriel Eady. At the same time their murders occurred, in 1943, London was the scene of many brutal crimes. Serial killers were having a field day. At night, all streetlights were turned off in what was called blackout, an attempt to protect the city from aerial attacks. Unfortunately, it also gave the cover of darkness to many criminals. Crimes like looting and housebreaking were commonplace, and the number of sexual assaults and murders increased as well. Harry Dobkin was a man who killed his wife and then hid her body in the basement of a bombed-out church in Lambeth, central London. When he was caught, he admitted that he had hoped people would assume she was a victim of an air raid. Evil men seemed to capitalize on the chaos of the war. Police were low on manpower, and many crimes went undetected. One of these killers who roamed the streets of post-war London was Neville Heath, also known is the Lady Killer. He was responsible for the brutal, sexually charged murders of at least two women in 1946. The acid bath murderer, John George Hay, also operated during the same time as Christie. He was a fraudster who would live in hotels and check out without paying. He would become acquainted with wealthy people and worm his way into their lives before killing them and selling their assets for his own personal gain. He would dispose of his victims' bodies by placing them in barrels filled with concentrated sulfuric acid. The bodies simply melted away. He would give it a day or two until all the remains had been reformed by the acid, and then he would pour the sludge into the sewer. The acid bath murders was a big news scoop at the time, and all eyes were on Hay, who had murdered six people between 1944 and 1948. Then there was also the chalk pit murderer, Thomas Lee. He was an Australian politician whose political opponents often disappeared or jumped off cliffs. He was arrested in the UK for kidnapping, torturing, and killing a man, leaving his body in a chalk pit. New bodies seemingly turned up every week. It was perhaps because of all these people disappearing and ending up murdered that John Reginald Christie's crimes remained undetected for as long as they did. After the trial of Tim Evans, the landlord of Rillington Place sold the property. The new landlord was Jamaican-born Charles Brown. Brown was one of many people who flocked to London from the West Indies in the 1950s. The Christies did not get on with Charles Brown. They complained to him for allowing other Jamaicans to stay in their building. The problem mainly emanated from racism, with the Christies being uncomfortable about living in the same building as people of color. Christie guarded the back garden like a hawk, clearly fearing that the new neighbors could discover the bodies of Ruth First and Muriel Eady. He was a mess and visited his doctor 33 times in 8 months, seeking help for his anxiety and insomnia. In early December of 1952, out of the blue, he quit his job. He told his boss that he had found a better job in Sheffield and that he was planning on leaving London in early 1953. Soon after, Ethel, his wife of 30 years, disappeared. Christie told neighbors that she had already moved to Sheffield to set up their new home. To other people, he said that she was with her sick sister in Birmingham. None of this was true. Ethel had the misfortune of becoming Christie's fifth victim. He planned out her murder and a way to keep her family at bay. On the 10th of December, Ethel wrote a letter to her sister and asked Christie to post it. He never sent it, but he told her that he had. He kept the letter as his plan to get Ethel out of the way was about to be put into action. The next day, Ethel went to her friend Rosie to watch television. The following day, she took her washing to Maxwell Laundries and seemed cheerful. She never mentioned to anyone that she had plans to go away, let alone leave London for good. On Sunday, the 14th of December, 1952, John Reginald Christie strangled his wife, Ethel, in bed. He would later say that she was choking on medication. It was sleeping tablets that he received from hospital for his insomnia. He believed that she tried to end her life because of all the stress with the Jamaican neighbors at Rillington Place. But she did not simply fall asleep. She was choking, gasping for air. He couldn't stand to see her suffer, so he strangled her. He did not abuse her body sexually like his other victims. He left her in bed for 2 days before disposing of her body. The day after her death, he changed the date on Ethel's letter to her sister from the 10th to the 15th of December and posted it. He even sent some Christmas cards to relatives, signed, "From Ethel and Reg." To dispose of his wife's body, he lifted the floorboards and placed her below, and that's where he kept her. He said he didn't want to be separated from her. He wanted to keep her close, in the house with him. This couple seemed to be a solid team, devoted to each other. Even though Christie was unfaithful to Ethel, they supported each other in other ways, and it was hard to believe that he would end her life. Later on, police theorized that after Christie and Ethel had performed the abortions, they would take the young ladies into the parlor to recover and regain consciousness. Perhaps, at one stage, Ethel walked in as he was interfering with an unconscious girl who had just had an abortion. She was appalled and threatened to expose him to the police. That is when he decided Ethel had to go. There was another theory as well, perhaps more plausible. It was that Ethel figured out what had really happened to Beryl and Geraldine, and that Christie allowed Tim Evans to be accused of killing his own wife and daughter, and watched him go to the gallows for a crime he did not commit. 2 days after Ethel's death, Christie sold her wedding band to a local jeweler. He kept writing letters to her sister in Sheffield, explaining that he was writing on Ethel's behalf as her rheumatism prevented her from writing herself. Christie spent the festive season by himself at 10 Rillington Place, with the decomposing body of Ethel to keep him company. In the first week of January 1953, he sold most of their furniture as he had no income. He was sleeping on a mattress and only had one chair in the parlor. Things are spiraling out of control. Ethel's sister continued correspondence with her, but never received any letters back from Ethel. Her brother also hadn't heard from her, and their letters to Ethel and Christie went unanswered. Before the end of March, three more women would be dead. Rita Nelson was a young lady who found herself with an unwanted pregnancy. She met Christie at a cafe, Lyons Tea Shop. Rita worked as a waitress and was a robust, colorful woman. She had a criminal record for theft, public drunkenness, and soliciting. Christie was charmed by her Northern Ireland accent and had to have her. He offered a solution to her pregnancy problem. That is how Rita became his next victim. He followed the same procedure as he had done with the other women. He drugged her with coal gas, strangled her, and raped her. Then, he simply placed her body in an alcove in the kitchen and closed it up with wallpaper. Rita's landlady reported her missing on the 19th of January, after Rita had not been home for a week. But Rita never turned up again. Christie's next victim was an acquaintance of his, Kathleen Maloney. She was known as Kay, although Christie later referred to her as Kathy. Kay was full of life and had many brushes with the law. Charges included soliciting, assaulting a police officer, and using language most foul. At one court, she told magistrates, "I am happy-go-lucky and have had a few drinks." She was a vagrant, and friends said, as she had nowhere to stay, she would often go home with men, and if they gave her some money afterwards, it was a bonus. Around the time of Ethel's death, Christie went to a room with Kay and one of her friends. He convinced the friend to take her clothes off so he could take nude photographs of her. Kay refused. Christie took off his own clothes and asked Kay to take photos of him and her friend. Kay complied, but her refusal to undress drove him wild with lust, and he could not get her out of his mind. Christie saw Kay around town and felt sorry for her. He gave her some of Ethel's old clothes. Kay told a bartender that someone offered her a place to stay. That someone was probably Christie. So when he saw her towards the end of January, somewhat inebriated at a pub, he took her home. Earlier that night, she admitted to someone that she had had the equivalent of 8 pints of beer. She wasn't really capable of defending herself, so it was not difficult to place the mask on her face that would render her unconscious. He then had sex with her, and then strangled her. He left Kay's body in the string chair in the kitchen all night. Some reports say he had a cup of tea with her body opposite him at the breakfast table. He placed her in the kitchen alcove, along with Rita Nelson. Scottish-born Hectorina McLennan had been in London for a while. She had quite a bad reputation and a couple of arrests for soliciting. Hectorina, known to her friends as Ina, needed a place to stay. Christie overheard her talking to someone at a cafe and invited her to stay with him, but when she arrived with her boyfriend Alex Baker, Christie wasn't impressed. Still, he let them stay. After 3 awkward days, they left. Christie asked Ina to visit him one last time before they moved on, and that is when he strangled her. Alex came looking for her, concerned that she never came back after meeting with Christie. Christie said she never turned up. He even pretended to look for her with Alex, made him a cup of tea, and theorized about what could have happened to Ina. Of course, they never found her. Christie even followed up, finding Alex and asking if Ina had come back. All the while, he knew that she never would. By the end of March, Christie's anxiety got the better of him. He felt that it was time to move on before he was found out. He sublet his apartment to a Mr. and Mrs. Riley without the consent of his landlord. In fact, he pretended to be the landlord. He also swindled some money from new tenants by insisting that they paid 3 months' rent in advance. Christie even took his dog Judy to the vet and had her put down. The cat, he left with Mr. and Mrs. Riley. Then he started drifting, moving around London in order to avoid capture. The landlord of 10 Rillington Place heard about the new tenants and went to see them. He told the Rileys that their rental agreement was not valid and kicked them out. Although they had lost their money, they were quite happy to leave, as there was a terrible stench in the apartment. The whole place was filthy. They did not know what caused the horrible smell, and suspected it was coming from the factory next door. With the ground floor apartment empty, the landlord allowed the upstairs tenant, Beresford Brown, to use the Christie's old kitchen. Beresford Brown was a jazz musician from Jamaica. The smell in the place was unbearable, so Beresford took it upon himself to fix things up and clean the place out. When he wanted to install a shelf on the wall to put his wireless radio on, he found a sheet of wallpaper covering an alcove. As he removed the wallpaper, the horror of what was hiding in the walls of 10 Rillington Place was finally revealed. He saw the body of a woman, rolled up in a blanket, leaning forward with her back to the opening. The stench overwhelmed him, and Beresford called for police. Police arrived in full force, and this time did a comprehensive search of the entire property. They started with the alcove in the dilapidated kitchen, pointed out by Beresford Brown. The first body was that of Ina McLennan. Then they found the bodies of Rita Nelson and Kay Maloney, who were contorted into the space behind Ina. Police did not look good. Just 3 years before, they had searched the same property and sent a man to the gallows for murder. Yet there were more dead bodies at the same address. In the late winter, early spring of the 1950s, the average temperature inside homes in London was just below 60 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 14 degrees Celsius. The kitchen at 10 Rillington Place was below street level, and the alcove was kept at a constant 40 degrees, that's 5 degrees centigrade. The bodies were definitely in a stage of decomposition, but they were quite well preserved, which made identification much easier. All three women had been strangled and then covered with blankets, tied with their own stockings or bras. Christie had tucked a vest between the legs of his victims to serve as a makeshift diaper after he had raped them. Alex Baker identified Ina's clothes when police presented him with it. The fact that Ina, Rita, and Kay had criminal records meant police had their fingerprints on file. They could positively identify the women without much trouble. Later, pathologists found carbon monoxide in all three bodies. All of them were in their mid-20s and had a pinkish color due to the gas. They also found that Rita Nelson was 6 months pregnant and Ina McLennan 6 weeks. If the killer was so brazen as to hide his victims inside the wall, where else could he have left them? Police would rip up floorboards and demolish the ceiling planks. That is when they found Ethel's body beneath the floorboards in the parlor. She was also wrapped in a blanket, but unlike the women in the kitchen, she had nothing shoved between her legs. Extending their search to the communal garden, police found the remains of Ruth Furst and Muriel Eady. The discovery was made by accident, when one officer realized that a human thigh bone was supporting a fence. Identifying the remains proved to be quite a challenge. They examined dental records and were able to determine that one of the victims had a crown that had been fitted in Germany or Austria. When looking through missing persons reports, they found that Ruth Furst lived 2 blocks away from Christie at the time of her disappearance. As a kind of timestamp, Christie had buried a newspaper from 1943 with Ruth's body. When questioned by police, he claimed that Ruth Furst was madly in love with him and found the fact that he was a married man who was unavailable to her irresistible. This, of course, was Christie's point of view. Ruth had just turned 21 weeks before her murder. Christie was more than 20 years older than her, and not particularly desirable. One account said that he always looked like he had just stepped out of a cold shower, timid and shaky. Christie admitted that after the police search in December 1942, when Beryl and Geraldine Evans' bodies were found, his dog Judy dug up Muriel Eady's skull from the back garden. He proceeded to dispose of it in a bombed-out house on St. Mark's Road nearby. This was corroborated by an autopsy that found the skull belonged to a woman aged 32 to 34 who had suffered from nasal catarrh. The shock when they realized how long ago Ruth and Muriel were murdered was intense. Christie had started killing an entire decade before. How many more victims were they looking for? 2 women came forward, Mary O'Neill and Helen Sunderland. Mary said that she met Christie at the end of January 1953 and went back to Rillington Place with him. He reportedly wanted sex from her, and when she said no, he said that she would not be missed if he were to kill her. Mary bluffed and told Christy that she had told a friend exactly where she was and who she was with. In doing so, she most probably saved her own life. Helen had a similar story, although she said that sex was never offered by her or expected by Christy. A strange find in the apartment was a tobacco tin with four clumps of pubic hair inside, none of which belonged to any of the known victims. Could this have been a trophy from other victims, or simply a keepsake from his sexual indiscretions? A large manhunt to find John Reginald Christie was launched. Police were able to confirm that he withdrew £10 from his wife's banking account and that he was drifting around London. He slept in hostels for men, registering under his real name, making no effort to disguise his identity. He went to various pubs and was spotted all over town. Christie was bald, with a sharp face and thin lips, and recognizable round black-rimmed glasses. Police knew that they would be able to identify him as soon as they saw him. His photo was in every newspaper. Articles about the gruesome findings at 10 Rillington Place featured on every front page. People swarmed to the property to have a look for themselves. Some even took keepsakes, pieces of debris that were left after police excavated the property. People wanted a part of what they knew would be a historic case. The public also reported sightings of anyone resembling Christie, and police were on high alert. Christie called a newspaper and said he was ready to turn himself in. Police were hunting him like a dog, and he was tired of it. He was cold and lost and did not have a change of clothes. But when the journalist set up a rendezvous, Christie saw the journalist with two policemen close by, so he ran away and left the journalist waiting. On March 31st, a man fitting Christie's description was stopped on the embankment near Putney Bridge, just in front of the old Star and Carter pub. The police officer noticed the man, as it looked like he was about to jump into the Thames. The officer approached him and politely asked if he was looking for employment. The man said that he was waiting for his employment papers to come through. When asked to identify himself, the man said he was John Waddington. The man was John Reginald Christie. By this time, he had been wandering the streets of London for 10 days. The last name he used was his wife Ethel's family name, Waddington. The officer hailed a passing police van, and Christie was bundled inside. On his person, police found his identity documents, as well as a newspaper clipping of an article about the remand of Tim Evans. When he arrived at the station, he did not waste any time in trying to gain sympathy. He told them, in his breathless voice, "I have not been well for a long while, 18 months. I have been suffering from fibrositis and enteritis. I had a breakdown in hospital." Police did not take pity on him, as they had witnessed the horror of his actions back at his home. Christie confessed to four murders, the bodies which had been found at 10 Rillington Place. Police confronted him with the fact that they had dug up two more bodies in the garden, and Christie started talking. He said he killed Ethel because she was choking anyway. The other women were all women of ill repute, and he said that they were aggressors. His story about Rita Nelson's murder was quite ridiculous. He said that he had met her on the street, and she demanded money from him. When he refused to give it to her, she threatened that she would scream and accuse him of assaulting her. He walked away, and she followed him into his home, where her hysterical behavior continued. She took a frying pan and wanted to hit him with it. A scuffle ensued, and she fell backwards onto a chair that had a rope hanging from it. Christie claimed he then blacked out and woke up to find that Rita had been strangled due to this unfortunate incident. He made himself a cup of tea, then went to bed. The next morning, he prepared the alcove so that he could hide her body inside. As for Kay Maloney, he remembered taking her home and disposing of her body. He could not remember killing her, however. Christie later said, "It was little Kathy I felt sorry for. She was a sweet kid. I felt sorry for her." With a monster like Christie, one can only but question the sincerity of his statement. This was probably the most remorse he ever showed. Christie alluded to being responsible for Beryl Evans's death. He refused to confess to the murder of 18-month-old Geraldine Evans, as seeing as Tim was charged only with Geraldine's murder and not Beryl's. Christie's denial also absolves him from any guilt regarding Tim's wrongful execution. Also, strangling an innocent child would make him, in the public's eyes, an even bigger monster, he could justify the killings of the women, whom he all portrayed as being of loose morals and deserving of it, but there was no way to talk his way out of killing a toddler. He was responsible for 6 murders, but could only be tried for 1. The Crown decided the strongest case would be to charge him with the murder of his wife, Ethel Christie. An autopsy revealed that she did not have any sleeping tablets or medication in her system at the time of her death, so Christie's explanation of assisted suicide was simply not true. Also, it would be easier to find a motive for killing his wife than explore his psychological issues and sexual deviance in killing the other women. While on remand at Brixton Prison, Christie had one photo up on his wall. It was not a photo of his wife or his beloved dog Judy, but a photo of himself. His trial began on the 22nd of June, 1953. Proceedings took place in the same courtroom as the trial of Tim Evans did 3 years earlier. But this time, Christie was not the star witness. The tables had turned, and all eyes were on him. So many people attended the trial at the Old Bailey, there was only standing room. The defense tried to push for an insanity plea. Guilty, but insane at the time of the murders. That would have been the only way to explain what had happened. Christie took the stand and spoke eloquently, but kept his voice so low that most people could not hear everything he said. He admitted that, "All my life, I've had this fear of appearing ridiculous as a lover." The most disconcerting question during the trial was when he was asked how many people he had killed. You could hear a pin drop in the courtroom as Christie's raspy voice cut through the silent anticipation. "I don't know." He explained the circumstances of Beryl Evans's death by saying that he only helped her to end her own life. He found her in her apartment, lying on the floor in front of the fire, and the place smelled of gas. He opened a window to avoid an explosion. He claimed she offered to have sex with him if he would kill her afterwards. He refused, because of his ailing back. Then he took a piece of gas tubing, which he held to her face, and when she was unconscious, he strangled her. Beryl's body was exhumed in May 1953, and another autopsy was performed. The results confirmed the original post-mortem examination, that Beryl's cause of death was strangulation. No traces of gas or carbon monoxide poisoning were found, contradicting Christie's statement that she was in the process of killing herself, also that he had used his usual method to render her unconscious. After a 4-day trial, on the 25th of June, 1953, John Reginald Christie was sentenced to death. He showed little remorse. In fact, he looked proud of his skill as a killer. He saw himself as an unwitting participant in all the murders, and in some cases, like Ethel and Beryl's murders, an angel of mercy. He did not appeal his sentence and admitted to all of the murders, except, of course, for the murder of 1-year-old Geraldine. Considering that in today's world, there is a legal term for killing an unborn child, child destruction in British law, or foeticide in the US, is, quote, "the crime of killing an unborn but viable fetus, that is, a child capable of being born alive before it has a separate existence," unquote. That would include the loss of life of the unborn baby of Rita Wilson, who was 6 months pregnant. Although she was not yet 24 weeks pregnant, Beryl Evans's unborn child also died with her, which brings Christie's known body count up to 10. John Reginald Halliday Christie was hanged a couple of weeks after sentencing at Pentonville Prison by the same executioner who carried out Tim Evans's hanging, Albert Pierrepoint. What Christie's last thoughts must have been, dying at the same gallows as Tim Evans, one can only wonder. He probably didn't even give Tim or any of his victims a second thought. The public was appeased that Christie was made to pay the ultimate price for his crimes. However, it became evident that Christie also had the blood of Tim Evans on his hands. The fairness of the legal system was questioned, and Tim's case was widely discussed as being the greatest miscarriage of justice in English history at that time. Because he was hanged so soon after his sentence, it could not be undone. People were appalled at the thought that this could only be one of many cases of wrongful conviction. Calls to abolish the death penalty came from all over the country. An inquiry was conducted immediately after Christie's execution, led by John Scott Henderson. The outcome was to stand by the initial ruling. According to the official report, Christie's confession about killing Beryl was false, which means that Tim Evans was guilty after all. Most people in Britain were not happy about this. Chances of two violent murderers living in the same building at the same time were slim. Other people firmly believed that, despite Christie's confession about killing Beryl Evans, the original verdict that found Tim Evans guilty was correct. Because Christie never admitted to Little Geraldine's murder, opinions remain divided. It still does, even to this day. However, the majority of people believe that Tim was as much of a victim of Christie as the women were. Tim's mother, Thomasina Probert, kept advocating to clear her son's name. She even appealed directly to the Queen, begging for another inquest in the 1950 case against him. But in the end, Tim's case played a vital role in the abolition of the death penalty in England in 1965. The Braben Inquiry was a full judicial investigation that was conducted in the early 60s. In 1966, 16 years after he was executed, Tim Evans finally received a posthumous royal pardon. Surprisingly, not because Braben believed him to be completely innocent. The report stated that Tim was probably responsible for Beryl's death, and Christie probably killed Geraldine. But seeing as Tim was only tried and convicted of Geraldine's murder, his sentence was reversed. His body was exhumed from the prison cemetery and reburied in a cemetery in Leytonstone, London. Had anyone listened to the simple-minded Tim Evans back in the day, four of Christie's victims could have been saved. The gruesome story of events that played out between 1943 to 1953 was made into a film in the 1970s called 10 Rillington Place, with the late Sir Richard Attenborough in the role as Christie and the late Sir John Hurt playing Tim Evans. The movie was filmed on location in the actual Rillington Place and gives a good feeling of the claustrophobic living conditions. Attenborough's portrayal of Christie also gives a chilling insight into the dark and twisted world of one of England's most notorious serial killers. The street Rillington Place no longer exists today. It was renamed Ruston Close after Christie's execution due to the influx in public interest in the address. In the late 50s, the new tenant was Jamaican-born ex-RAF corporal Gaston King. He was a plumber by trade, but struggled to find a job. He was a refined man who felt embarrassed by his living conditions. In an interview with a newspaper, he said that during his first year in the house, he was often woken up by the stifling presence of a woman in his room. He was desperate to end the visits, and even resorted to burning incense in an attempt to smudge her spirit away. This house of horrors at 10 Rillington Place, Notting Hill, was demolished in the 1970s. But the memory of what happened within its walls will never be erased from history. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. And join our Facebook group so you can review and chat about other cases we've covered with other listeners. If you like our podcast, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We would also appreciate it if you could review the episodes, as it gives us some street cred in the world of podcasting. While you're waiting for our next episode, why not listen to one of our podcasting friends?
Hi, I'm Roseanne, host of the California Dreaming Podcast, a show that delves into the darker side of the not-so-golden state. Together, we will visit some of the most unhinged and chilling crimes that ever shook California and beyond. Join me as I take you on a journey into a new story each week with a different backdrop from all around California, from the bright lights and glamour of Hollywood to the picturesque and tranquil wine country. No crime, no town, nobody is off limits. Listen to California Dreaming on the Orbital Jigsaw Network or anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Bethan.
And we are the hosts of a new UK true crime podcast, Seeing Red.
We're planning to bring you an episode of Seeing Red every Wednesday, and we'll be taking it in turns to tell each other about a crime. The cases we're going to talk about will be from the UK.
We'll be covering scams, robberies, murders, and everything in between.
Some cases will be solved, but some will be mysteries, and we hope you'll enjoy listening to us discussing our theories on these.
So let's tell you a little bit about us. We've known each other for about 5 years and we absolutely love true crime. So we thought the next logical step for us would be a true crime podcast.
You can find Seeing Red on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And why not follow us on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter to join a discussion thread about the case.
Just search for Seeing Red, a UK true crime podcast.
This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.